This is the What Matters Most podcast. A 100% listener-supported program. And now, here is your host, Paul Samuel Dolman.
Welcome back to What Matters Most. I am feeling excited today about my guest and also all you people around the world who keep writing in or listening. The numbers keep going up. Not that it matters. It's not so much the quantity, but the quality. And that really is the guests and you, the listeners. So keep the notes coming. Thanks to everyone who participates. When this book came my way, I devoured it. And it's fascinating. And also the writer, it has a great story. The book's called Grace, President Obama and 10 Days in the Battle for America, written by the chief White House speechwriter. It's an honor to welcome to the family for the first time, Mr. Cody Keenan. Thanks for coming on.
It's so nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the other more trivial matters, I wanted to ask you about your beloved Chicago Cubs, who currently are sitting 21 games under 500.
It's not great. I was watching the trade deadline news over the summer like everybody else and just kind of shaking my head. It's rough. This is the first year, too, I bought into a friend's season ticket, so my timing is spectacular.
Not a stock picker. How was it to win finally after 106 years, was it, when you guys finally won that thing and it was a nail biter?
It was 108 years. It was a nail biter. It went seven games against Cleveland with a rain delay in the middle of the ninth, and we had to win in extra innings, but it was worth it. I mean, I was born in Wrigleyville, literally, and you know, my dad and I could walk to the ballpark. So I just grew up a Cubs fan, and for it to finally happen, you know, I always used to joke with people when they'd ask, when are you going to leave the White House? Because it's pretty rare for people to stay all 8 years. I think we had more people do that than any other administration, but I'd always joke, not until the Chicago Cubs win the World Series and come for their visit. And they finally did. We actually had to kind of work with the team a little bit, because usually, you know, it was President Obama's last year and he was going to leave office. And usually the team that wins the World Series comes the following summer when they're in town to play the Nationals. And even before the election, we were like, look, I'll be damned if we let Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump welcome the Cubs. Like, Obama promised change. This is change. We're going to make this happen. And it was difficult because the team, you know, everyone goes on vacation over the winter. And so we had to work pretty hard with the team to get everyone to come. But once they put it to the team, almost everybody showed up. I think there were only two no-shows. And it was 4 days before we left office. So, you know, there was plenty of time in the schedule, and the president obviously came and took pictures with everyone on the team, which he doesn't usually do. The first lady came, which she had never done for a sports event at the White House, but she told the team, and it was just silent in the East Room. She told the team, or in the state dining room where we met before the event, she told the team how she used to sit on her father's lap when she was a little girl and watch Cubs games on WGN. And you see these big, tough players. Like, I saw Javi Baez wiping away a tear. It was a pretty amazing moment. And just to wrap up the story, you know, typically for a championship sports team visit, we tried to keep the president's remarks to 5 minutes because he's got other stuff to do. I took the Cubs remarks for myself because, you know, I was the chief speechwriter and I could do that. And because it was my life. So I write this. It was my last speech in the White House and it was beautiful, man. I like poured my heart and soul, and I found all these amazing vignettes about, you know, grown men who listened to the World Series on the radio at their father's gravestones, you know, so that they could be with their dad when the Cubs won the World Series. And so I hand the president his speech and he goes, "This looks pretty long." And I go, "Yeah, it's about 20 minutes. he was like, "Okay." So it was just great. It was such a good way to kind of exit in what was a pretty nostalgic, bittersweet week.
Oh, it's a beautiful story. And watching the series and watching that game, I honestly thought they were going to blow it and rip our hearts out again.
I mean, I'm a Cubs fan, so did I. I got to go to, I went to all three games in Chicago. I took my dad to game three because he'd taken me to so many games going up. I figured I'd repay it a little bit. I went with a buddy to game four and I took my little sister to game five. And, you know, we lost games three and four and we're suddenly down 3-1. And I'm worried that it's me. So I take my sister, Carly, and Cubs win game five. And we're back in this thing, you know, and the park was just singing Sweet Home Chicago and Go Cubs Go for like 15 minutes after the game. It was magical. But so President Obama is, you know, I didn't tell him I was going to the games. And, you know, we're traveling the country to campaign for Hillary Clinton at the time. And finally, I get an email from him being like, are you coming to Ohio tomorrow? And I'm like, well, I'm at the Cubs game. And he goes, are you ever coming back? Like, are you going to come out on the campaign trail? I was like, yeah, I'll be there tomorrow. So I sat out. I did not travel for games 6 and 7 with the Cubs. I mean, but I do remember I was on, I don't remember which game it was, but Addison Russell, the shortstop, hit a grand slam. And we were on Marine One coming back to the White House from some event. And I was watching it on my phone because you're low enough to get cell reception. And the president's in the middle of some story. And I just let out a giant whoop, like yelp, on the helicopter. And he just looks at me like, what are you doing? And I was like, the Cubs hit a grand slam.
And he's a huge sports fan, isn't he?
Yeah, big time. He's a White Sox guy, which he ribbed me about the very first day I met him. But you know, mostly NBA, Bulls. He's into the Bears, White Sox. But I think by now he's made a bunch of friends all over the leagues. So he's still loyal to Chicago, but I think his loyalties are a little more flexible than they used to be.
How did you end up in that privileged position of power and just what an opportunity? Were you always a writer, Cody?
No, well, I'd always had kind of a facility with it. I was always a reader, which I think is really important to be a good writer. You want to be a great reader, because that's how, you know, you don't just learn about different styles, but you learn about people's lives. You kind of pick up a sense of empathy and be and understand people who are different from you. So I'd always been a voracious reader. And as far as writing goes, I credit my 11th grade English teacher, Kathy Wassel. She was the first person who ever gave me a C on anything. And, you know, like a little entitled prick, I went up to her at the end of class, like demanding to know why I got a C. And to her credit, she said, come back after school and I'll tell you. And I sat down with her and she walked me through every single edit she made, every correction, every strike through. And no one had taken the time to do that with me before. And she was right on all of them. So just taking that 11th grade class made me a better writer. And then I just kind of focused on it over the years. And I never thought about being a speechwriter until, well, not even this, but after it. I worked for Ted Kennedy for 4 years in the Senate, the last Kennedy brother, right out of college. And the 2004 Democratic Convention was in Boston, his hometown. So he was just so excited. He was like the host of all hosts. And, you know, there are very strict ethics rules in Congress. So if we wanted to come help with the convention, we had to take a week off work and go up there on our vacation time. But as a reward, we would get a floor pass for one night of the convention. And as luck would have it, I got mine for Tuesday night, which most considered the night with kind of the lowest wattage of star power, except for this young Illinois state senator named Barack Obama. And I'm just kind of wedged into a corner of the floor, you know, surrounded by people wearing 5 million buttons and balloons and all these things, craning my neck to try to see it. And here's this guy from my hometown who talks about politics the way I wanted it to be, the way I wished it was, the way I'd hoped it could become. And I was just mesmerized by it. Now, I go back to the Senate for 2 more years to keep working for Ted Kennedy. But sometime in 2005, my boss, a guy named Michael Myers, who was the senator's chief policy strategist, pokes his head around the door and asks me, hey, can you write a speech? And I don't think he meant like, do you know how? I think he meant like, I don't have the time. Can you do it for me? Because he wrote a lot of the senator's stuff. And I lied and said yes. So I stayed up all night long writing a 10-minute floor speech. It's not memorable, you know. It's one of those things where, you know, nobody's on the Senate floor watching. It's just the C-SPAN diehards at home and my parents who I told about it. And me and watching somebody read words that you've written was like a drug. It was electrifying. And so I got to do some more for Senator Kennedy. And in late 2006, just as the Obama campaign was starting to wrap up, maybe early 07, a woman who used to be Ted Kennedy's communications director and kind of a mentor of mine named Stephanie Cutter had gone to be communications director on the Kerry campaign, where she met a young speechwriter named Jon Favreau. And he became Barack Obama's speechwriter. And in early 07, she connected us and he hired me as his intern on the Obama campaign in Chicago. And I just kind of stuck with that job for the next 14 years.
And you mentioned something I was going to ask you about. When Obama, the president of the United States, is speaking your words across the globe or moving people, what did that feel like inside of you?
The first few times, I mean, it's like totally electric. The first thing I ever wrote for him was an opening statement at the NAACP candidate debate in 2007. I think there were still like, how many Democrats do we have? Like 19 or something. And it was just a 3-minute topper. But, you know, I watch him doing this. I was just like, holy shit, you know, this is a big deal. And my parents were not happy with Beaver joining that campaign because they didn't think he had a chance at winning. They just didn't think America was ready to elect a black man. They came around eventually. You know, I'd send it to him and be like, guys, check this out. And they would get excited for me too. But, you know, it's exciting, but it's also terrifying. You know, there's a campaign is exciting once you get into the White House and, you know, people are losing 800,000 jobs a month and you're mired in two wars and suddenly everything is on you. That's pretty scary. And, you know, you're asked in the very first week to write a speech about like the housing market collapsing and how we're going to fix it. And I'm like, well, I don't know anything about that. So you sit down with these policy experts from Treasury and, you know, you're in the chief of staff's office and you're in the Oval Office and you're trying, you know, you're looking around, you're like, holy shit, I'm in the Oval Office. But you're also trying to remind yourself, this is my job now. Save the history stuff for later, you know, take mental pictures later, pay attention. And as the years go on, you get better at it like anything else. But for me, that fear never truly went away. And I think that's what actually made me good at my job.
Did you lay awake at night too and worry?
All the time. I still have anxiety dreams. I had a dream last week. It's a recurring dream that the circumstances are always different. But, you know, I'm with President Obama and he doesn't have his speech, you know, because it's not ready, or I screwed up somehow, or it didn't make its way to the teleprompter. And there's always kind of this mad scramble. I mean, the fact that I'm still having those 5-6 years after the White House is a little concerning, but it never truly goes away. And, you know, I think I've talked about this before. I gave a commencement address on this. I don't agree when anyone ever says, don't be afraid to fail. You know, that suggests that you've got unlimited chances to fail and you've got a security blanket behind you, you know, like, oh, I'll just keep failing until I succeed. Well, I mean, that worked for Michael Jordan. That's one of his famous quotes. I failed and failed and failed again. That's why I succeed. But he also led the league in scoring when he failed, you know. For someone like me, I always approached it as I was so afraid to fail both the president and the country and my colleagues, that I would do anything it took to succeed. I would stay up all night long. I would kill myself to get a draft right. Like, you know, failure for me was not okay. And it convinced me to push myself harder.
How did the mechanics work? Did you write something and come to him and he's the editor, then just kind of picking words and then, or does he give you a draft and then you polish? Is it sometimes all you, more him? I mean, and is it all the above? Is there no set way?
It's all the above. There's no set way. It kind of depends on the speech. I mean, in general, he was our editor in chief. He would, no matter how small the remarks, he would work on them the night before. You know, sometimes he'd make one or two edits, no big deal, just to kind of show us that he looked at it. But, you know, he's a writer, which is why he's such a good speech maker. You know, he cared about it. He was involved in the process. It's a gift to have a speaker who's involved in editing and working on his speeches. For bigger speeches like, you know, a State of the Union address or like a speech in Selma or Charleston or the farewell address, he'll go through multiple drafts and mark them all up, send them back. And, you know, in the ideal situation, each draft you send each other gets better and you make each other better. That's when the collaboration is at its best. But, you know, for those big speeches too, we try to sit down with him on the front end and we'd call it the download. We'd give him a couple prompts to get his brain moving and he'd just kind of talk. He'd tell the story, you know, of what he wanted to say. And we just kind of furiously write it down on our laptops and then go get to work. When he really got involved and worked on a speech by hand, sometimes he'd even get out a yellow legal pad and write longhand. That's when he could really, the one thing we couldn't really emulate was his moral imagination. And he'd usually take a speech to a better place.
After 8 years, were you close friends or was there always that sort of professional divide?
I maintained a professional divide because he's still the president of the United States. I mean, we became, you know, we became tight. We would joke around. We'd We'd talk about pop culture when we were riding in the limousine. You know, he was generous enough to have me and my wife and our families and our wedding party over to the White House on our wedding day, and spent about an hour with us. So, you know, that's as close as we got, really. We had dinner together a few times, but it's not like, you know, I'm not going to text him at night and be like, hey, brother, you watching the Bulls game? I might email him that, you know, the next morning. And but these days, you know, I'll check in every month or two and send photos of our daughter just to keep him caught up, because he loves babies. They're like websites devoted to Obama playing with babies. But he's never gotten to meet mine because of COVID. So I keep sending him updates as she grows.
Well, he's down the road here in Martha's Vineyard. So you need to come up with the family, drag your favorite podcaster along. We'll go over there, shoot the bull, no pun intended, have some lobster or whatever we're going to eat, and hang with the crew.
I think we're allowed to talk about this now, but I was up there last year for his birthday party, and got to see the house. Yeah, that was very hush-hush at the time. But a reporter caught me and my wife eating it at one of your fine dining establishments the next day, and I think the gig was up.
I think everybody blew the non-disclosure. There was so much talk about it, and we saw Springsteen walking around, Spielberg, Bradley Cooper. I mean, it's small. You were here. It's not that big a deal here.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, that was kind of fun. We were just like sitting around. We took my sister, too, so she could babysit our daughter. And we were all just having lunch the next day and just like celebrity spotting. It was wild.
Did you stay out at the Winnetou?
No, we rented an Airbnb.
Why does a guy need a speechwriter? Why can't I just get up there and say whatever the hell I want to say?
That's a great question. And Barack Obama had the same question when he was first elected to the Senate. Because, you know, he'd written Dreams for My Father. He was writing The Audacity of Hope. He wrote the 2004 speech that made him famous by himself. So Robert Gibbs, the first White House press secretary in the Obama administration, was then Senator Obama's new communications director. And he said, sir, we need to hire you a speechwriter. And Obama said, I don't want one. Gibbs explained it. He's like, well, here's the thing. Now that you're a senator, you're going to spend a third of your time, you know, doing the work of legislating. You're going to spend a third of your time fundraising. And you're going to spend a third of your time sitting in the president's chair in the Senate because you're 100th in seniority. You're not going to have time to write speeches. So you need somebody. And Gibbs brought in Jon Favreau, and he and Obama hit it off immediately. But as a president, you know, you need a speechwriter because, well, I think anyone, you know, in a position of authority or leadership should have a speechwriter, or at least take it seriously. I mean, you know, speechwriting is really just taking the time to craft a logical, linear argument that sticks with people and inspires them to action. You know, speechwriting is thinking before you speak, whereas tweeting is speaking before you think. And for someone whose words can move armies and move markets, I mean, it's pretty important to get things right. And he's very precise with his words. You know, it takes him a while to, he's a faster writer than I am. It takes me longer, but he's so precise with his words that by the time he takes the stage and a speech is in a teleprompter, you know, which his opponents would mock as like, oh, he needs a teleprompter. Well, first of all, they use a teleprompter. Second of all, you should. But third of all, it's because by the time the speech hits the teleprompter, he's been through it enough times that he has the remarks where he wants them down to the syllable. You know, if we did have enough time on a big speech, you almost treat it like a piece of music. You read it out loud to yourself and you can tell this sentence needs one more beat or one less beat, or we should split this sentence in two. It's because it's a performance in a way. But you know, as a speechwriter, I'd also have to work with a policy teams and fact checkers and lawyers. And, you know, everyone kind of gets their hands into a speech to make sure that it's perfect by the time it hits that teleprompter. So that's why a president needs a speechwriter. Also, you know, he gave 2,477 speeches and statements in the White House. And that would be very time consuming if he did it on his own.
What are you most proud of from the 8 years?
The Chicago Cubs winning the World Series. No, it's a good answer. I had nothing to do with it other than the speech. You know, I'm proud of, it's easy to say healthcare, killing bin Laden, doubling clean energy, but I guess I'll say it's the example he set and we set. that we were a tight-knit family that had been forged in a long and bitter campaign. And none of us felt like we deserved to be there. You know, we all sort of had imposter syndrome in a way. And kind of like fear, I think that makes you better at your job. You always feel this sense of proving it. You know, I don't think anyone in the Trump White House had imposter syndrome. I think they all felt like they deserved to be there. We didn't. We felt like we had to earn it. And we conducted ourselves in a way that could make the American people proud. You know, the lowest of bars, no one was ever indicted in the Obama administration. And that was like the first administration in decades I could say that. That's a pretty low bar, but it was one that only he cleared. But beyond that, you know, we tried to carry ourselves in a way that would make people proud. And that was especially not hard for him, but the world was watching him. You know, as the first Black president, he had to be twice as good. And he and the first lady and the girls, you know, the writer Ta-Nehisi Coates put it best, for 8 years, he walked on ice and never fell. And I think the true legacy of an administration is not just the laws you pass or even the way you conduct yourself, but it's what kind of young people at the time end up doing as a response to your administration. You know, you saw all these people go into public service after John F. Kennedy was president, right? And now you see it, and it's still early, but you see all these waves of young people running for office of, you know, all colors and creeds and backgrounds. And, you know, eventually that's going to make America a better, more representative place when, you know, Congress and state houses and the White House look more like the majority of the American people and have lived lives that most Americans have. So I think his legacy is going to, and what we're most proud of, is still to come, believe it or not.
Was the biggest disappointment the lack of gun legislation? My friends lost their daughter at Sandy Hook.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and he spent a lot of time with them behind closed doors, and a lot of tears were shed, I can say that. And also, he really wanted to get that done, and when he wept in front of the world there, I thought, at last. But unfortunately, no, we're having the shootings. We have these mass shootings every day, and just heartbreaking. Was that the biggest sort of disappointment for you or the administration? Or do you feel comfortable saying that?
For sure. You nailed it. I mean, and I go into this in the book. You know, I was tapped to write the eulogy after Newtown. And how do you eulogize 20 dead six-year-olds? You know, and six educators who died trying to protect them. It's impossible. And President Obama did spend a ton of time with those families. You know, it was the memorial service was 2 days after the shooting, so we had to write a eulogy real quick. But when we got up there, he spent 3 hours with the families at Newtown High School, because, you know, the Sandy Hook was still a crime scene. And it was the first time I'd ever seen Secret Service agents cry. But he spent time with every family. And, you know, the one thing that really got me was Pete Souza took these amazing photos of him posing with the little kids who were all the little siblings who were all dressed up and probably didn't understand where their big brother or sister had gone. And it just guts you. And, you know, he spent time with those families over the next couple months. This was, you know, he just won re-election and we were gearing up for the second term, and we put the second term agenda on hold to try to do something about guns. And he spent a lot of political capital on it and traveled the country. And we had a big rally in Hartford in early April with those families. And they flew back to the White House on Air Force One with the president. And I remember there was one, you know, the president gives a weekly address every Saturday, and it's something we tape on Fridays and then it goes out to the networks. And for the first time, we gave it over to somebody else. And it was two parents from Newtown. And I worked with them on what they would say. And they sat in front of the camera and I think it was one of the rooms in the lower level of the White House. And, you know, the wife did it in, the mother did it in one take, and just kind of just crumples right after that and starts crying. And just the room is silent. Nobody wants to say anything. And she looks up and she goes, "I can do that again if you need me to." And we were like, "Oh my God, no, like that's amazing." You just imagine how hard that was. And then for the Senate to vote down background checks, you know, again, like only in the United States Senate can something lose with 55 votes. 95% of Democrats voted for it. 95% of Republicans voted against it. 90% of Americans supported background checks, 80% of NRA households, or maybe 80% or 70% of NRA households. Like, it's just one of those no-brainers. And that's the most cynical I've ever seen the president. That was one of the three times I've ever seen the president angry, was after the Senate voted down background checks. You know, I prepared a speech for him and I handed it to him before he was going to go out to the Rose Garden with those families who had just watched from the Senate gallery as background checks were shot down. No pun intended. And I handed it to him and he said, I'm not going to make any edits to this. I'll read from this, but I'm going to ad lib because I'm angry. And I was like, great, go nuts. You say whatever you want. And he was angry. If you watch it, it's on YouTube. You know, he had, much like he had the day of the Newtown shootings, when I had to prepare a statement for him then, you know, he cried in the briefing room. And how could you not? You know, he cried after the part about how all these kind of birthdays and weddings and children of their own had been ripped away. That was the number one most viewed YouTube on the White House YouTube channel for a long, long time, or maybe number two, right behind the Bin Laden raid, because the president showed emotion. And then, you know, after background checks went down, he showed anger. And after that speech, he came back into the Oval Office and he was, you know, again, about as angry as I'd ever seen him. And he was almost yelling, you know, at nobody in particular, saying, what do I do the next time this happens? You know, I don't want to speak. I don't want to give another eulogy. What? It's not doing anything. You know, and it was kind of cathartic for him. It was rhetorical questions that I certainly didn't want to answer. You know, but the next time this happens, I don't want to speak. And, you know, obviously it kept happening, and I see where he's coming from. You know, it became this kind of routine after mass shootings where, you know, everybody argues for a little while and then nothing happens. The president gives a eulogy and we all move on. And I, you know, selfishly, as the person who had helped him write those, it always felt like, you know, it was our job to go absolve America of our collective sin of not doing anything about this. And we didn't want to do that anymore. You know, he flashed forward. He obviously had to a few more times. You know, there was a mass shooting at the Navy Yard. There was a second mass shooting at Fort Hood. And, you know, Charleston is kind of a whole different beast altogether. So there were times where he just had to.
How come we as a country cannot get this done?
The Senate filibuster. I mean, that it's as simple as that. It's, you've got 90% of the country that supports background checks. I mean, most Americans thought universal background checks was the law before Newtown, or after Newtown. You know, we had an assault weapons ban in place from 1994 to 2004. This is doable. And Republicans will just flood the zone, like, you know, I don't know if it's an octopus or whatever, but that kind of sea creature that'll like kick up sand to blind its prey. After every mass shooting, or blind a predator, after every mass shooting, you've got them saying, oh, it's guns, it's mental health, it's video games, mental health, it's liberals, you know, it's gay people, whatever, that's causing all these mass shootings. But it's never the gun, right? And you look at all these mass shootings, and more often than not, much more often than not, it's an AR-15. And you can look at other countries that don't have mass shootings. You know, we are an outlier on this. We're not uniquely crazy. We don't have unique mental health issues. We're not the only country with video games. It's absurd. So, and the easiest answer is, you know, we're not going to get 60 Democrats anytime soon. What we do need is enough Democrats. Right now, that would be 52 who are willing to reform the filibuster, or get rid of the filibuster, so that it only requires 50 votes to pass gun reforms. I mean, that's as simple as it gets. We've got 50 Democrats right now. We need two more who are willing to do it, because two of them aren't. You know, and every once in a while, I'll hear someone say, well, Obama had 60 Democrats in his first year, which is true. He did for 5 months, maybe. But that doesn't mean 60 of them were in favor of doing something about gun reforms. They weren't. 60 of them were not pro-choice. You know, I think at best, we had 52 pro-choice senators. We had 55 who were willing to do something about guns. So you need to get rid of the filibuster if we're ever going to make any progress on this whatsoever.
And you're a father of a beautiful little girl. Talk about worry and wonder. What kind of world is she going to grow up in? What if she goes to the wrong mall, the movie theater, school?
I worry about that all the time. It's, you know, it's, everyone always tells you that you're being a parent is going to be a unique terror, but you don't know it until you have one. But I worry about her all the time. And like, that's the truly mind-boggling thing for me about, you know, Republicans not doing anything on guns, it's they're not safe either. You know, you're not suddenly protected from gun violence just because you're taking money from the NRA. This happens at movie theaters and churches and grocery stores and nightclubs and schools. Like, you're not safe. Your kids aren't safe. What the fuck? Like, at some point, there needs to be some sort of self-preservation here, because especially as a parent, like you said, you think about it all the time. What if the playground is the wrong place to be? You know, it's the right place to be, but what if it's the wrong place to be at the wrong moment, or school, or just walking down the street, or whatever? It's terrifying. And it's like, it's just enraging that nobody does anything about it. But the one thing that I would always caution people against is don't fall into this trap saying nothing's ever going to get done. All politicians are the same. All politicians are bad, because it's just not true. There are politicians who want to do something about this. We just need a couple more and it'll get done. And there are really great organizations that are working on this. You know, in the book, I talk a lot about these incredible moments over those 10 days. They weren't necessarily, you know, those victories didn't belong to President Obama alone. You had a 100-year movement for universal health care. You had a 50-year movement for LGBTQ plus rights. And then kind of out of the Obama administration, out of these tragedies, you've got this kind of burgeoning movement led by mothers against gun violence. You have Moms Demand, you have Everytown. And they have been quietly notching victories in, you know, blue state legislatures across the country. But when Congress couldn't get it done in 2013, a bunch of states did and passed laws. Now, you still need a federal law, right? Like, everyone, conservatives love to point at Chicago. Well, most of the guns seized in Chicago come from Indiana, which is a half hour away. So that's why you do need federal laws to protect this. And, like, you know, of course, they're not going to stop every mass shooting, but what if it stopped one or two? You know, what if it stopped the one that you're going to be involved in? It's just mind-boggling. It's so simple to fix, and I can see why people get cynical and angry about it, and they should, but they should also harness that and channel it into just electing two or three more Democrats to get this done.
I love your passion, because it's well placed. And by the way, the great Shannon Watts, the humble Shannon Watts, who founded Moms Demand Action after Sandy Hook in Newtown, has been on the show multiple times. One of my favorite people. And
she's so inspiring.
Isn't she amazing?
Yeah.
Another favorite of mine and a friend favorite of yours, if you don't mind giving her a few words, not every politician is the same, especially this one, Gabby Giffords.
Ugh, well, I mean, there is no politician like Gabby Giffords. You know, there are two kind of people in American politics who choke me up at the simple sight of them. You know, I'll kind of feel my throat constrict a little and kind of the backs of my eyes well up. And one was John Lewis and the other is Gabby Giffords. You know, I had to... It sounds like boasting, but it's not, trust me, it's not a thing of boasting about. You know, I had to work with the president on the eulogy after the memorial service after she was shot too. And, you know, that was just as hard. They're all hard. And I went to Tucson with the president. This one was, I think it was like 4 days, 4 or 5 days after the shooting. And I was outside the hospital waiting with the motorcade, but President Obama was in the room with her when she opened her eyes for the first time. You know, I mean, She'd been shot in the head, and you know, the day it happened, CNN and NPR said she was dead. And later, you know, said, you know, we were wrong, we're sorry, but that's how bad it was. And then we go and give this eulogy that night. And a brief aside here, it's really interesting. Audiences and speeches. You know, we get to the memorial service was at the basketball arena at the University of Arizona, and as we walk in, the crowd is all chanting and cheering and wearing matching t-shirts and batting a beach ball around. And Robert Gibbs and I look at each other and we're like, are we in the wrong place? And you come to realize that this is the way they wanted to heal and move on. You know, the entire country had been kind of staring at Tucson as this, how could something so awful happen in a place like this, right? And I think they were almost defiant, saying, you know, we love each other and we love the city. It's not who we are. And the president was surprised by it too. If you watch the YouTube of that eulogy, I mean, we had written a eulogy. It was sad. I had pictured a grieving audience in my mind, not a cheering one. And you can see him adjust over the first 5 or 6 minutes of the speech. And by the end, he's, you know, riding the audience applause. And, you know, at one point there was like a 30-second standing ovation, and it was just, it was remarkable. The next time I saw Gabby Giffords was later in 2011, I think. Yeah, we went to what was supposed to be the final shuttle mission at Cape Canaveral. It was ultimately scrubbed due to rain, which like it made me really sad because I would have liked to see that. But she was there, walking very unsteadily. She had a helmet on. And again, you know, I just kind of felt that emotion rising in the back of my throat. But to watch how she's progressed, to watch Mark Kelly become a senator, to watch her start up Giffords to try to do something about guns, you know, and all while she's still trying to relearn how to talk and walk, is just what an extraordinary person.
She really is. How hard has it been to watch what came after, to have watched what came after you guys, and then the rise of fascism for you personally, and a lot of the good things you did get undone or at least pissed on, and to just have the pendulum of polarity swing so dramatically?
That sucks.
That's probably the G-rated version.
Yeah, no, it sucks. You know, you obviously hate seeing things that you worked on get undone. That's democracy. But for just stupid, petty, vindictive reasons is that much more annoying. You know, Trump got to work quickly on undoing the Paris, or pulling America out of the Paris Treaty, right? So I think the only countries that didn't belong were us and North Korea. You know, watching the Iran deal fall apart, now Iran's close to a nuke again. Just dumb, petty, vindictive bullshit. I mean, he couldn't undo Obamacare, which was personally satisfying. But, you know, to tear down a lot of what he tore down wasn't just Obama's stuff. It was decades of America's role and responsibility in the world. And, you know, how can another country trust America to do the right thing if we can so quickly elect somebody like that, maybe even reelect somebody like that? So it was infuriating. Now, he ultimately pretty much only accomplished cutting taxes for rich people. That's really the only kind of legislative thing he did. That obviously, you know, he undid a ton of environmental protections and regulations and you know, regulations that protected workers on the job and things like that. Those can be, you know, reinstated by Joe Biden if they haven't been already. I'd be surprised if they hadn't been. But what he really did that was awful and, you know, maybe irreversible, was kind of unleashing this madness on America, where kind of the worst of the country felt safe coming out in public and, you know, airing their views and you know, marching without hoods on. He made it okay. You know, I don't think Americans got any more racist after Donald Trump took office. I think he just gave them permission to be, and awful and hateful. You know, if you see, and this gets back to what I was saying about the way you conduct yourself, if you see that from the White House, well, then you can do anything you want. And that, it's hard to put that back into the bottle. You know, even somebody like Joe Biden, who is, you know, just kind of old and gentle and, you know, he's like everybody's Uncle Joe, just because he carries himself that way doesn't mean the rest of the country is going to. It's hard to put that back in the bottle once it's out. That to me is kind of the most damaging legacy of the Trump presidency.
Were you shocked when he was elected?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I mean, at minimum, surprised. I don't know if I was shocked. We didn't expect it. You know, I'm not going to say that. You know, I probably wouldn't have gone to all three World Series games in Chicago, but, yeah, I was surprised and disappointed. And, you know, you still, even in those first moments, didn't imagine just how truly awful it would be. You know, I think we were just hopeful in the beginning that he was just going to be kind of a buffoon. I mean, you'd seen what he'd said all campaign, so all the signs were there. But, you know, I ultimately believed that he just wanted to be liked and respected and would do whatever it took to get that. But I was wrong. And you quickly figure that out after the first month or two of the administration.
What do you feel about the rise of fascism in our country?
Oh, I'm not happy about it. It's awful. And it gets back to this not just the kind of sense of cynicism that nothing's getting done, but this is sort of the larger struggle at the heart of my book and at the heart of American politics. And President Obama gave the book its thesis. I mean, you know, first and foremost, the book just kind of tells this, it focuses on these 10 days in June 2015. And it's just, you know, I think a great story that needed to be told. This is something that I wanted my daughter to know. But at the heart of the book is this thesis that President Obama came up with for his speech in Selma, which is, you know, America and American politics is not a clash of armies. It's a clash of wills, you know, and we're all engaged in this contest to determine the true meaning of America. And you've got this kind of revanchist movement on the right that is angry about, you know, the fact that not enough has been done to make their economic prospects better over the year. They're angry about immigrants and, you know, Black people and Latinos and women gaining power and gay people and coarsening the culture and just everything. They're mad that their country has, quote unquote, been taken from them, and they're going to take it back. You know, they're represented by kind of the Bull Connor on the other side of the bridge. And then you've got this rising America, this actual majority of America that is, you know, younger and browner and gayer and more tolerant of other people and cultures, and wants to do something about climate change, wants to do something about guns, wants to, you know, make the economy actually reflect the times we live in. And that's the battle. It's what is America? What is the meaning of America? Are we a country where, you know, just a few, you know, Christian white nationalists get to have power and use that power to punish everybody else? Or are we a country where, you know, it's messier and harder, but we all not just coexist, but thrive in a multiracial, multicultural democracy where everybody is equal and everybody has an equal chance? You know, it was luck and circumstance that over the course of that week, over the course of that 10 days, you had, you know, the Confederate flag start coming down in public spaces in the South and the Supreme Court deciding that, you know, working class folks and middle class folks deserve the right to health insurance like everybody else, and that same-sex couples deserve the right, same right to marriage equality as everybody else. It was luck and circumstance that all those things happened in a 10-day span, but they were also the result of people who had been pushing for decades. And that's what democracy is. It is unsatisfying. It is often frustrating, but it's a hell of a lot better than the alternative where, you know, just one asshole and his little gang of assholes gets to decide what your life looks like.
Perfectly framed. As a father for a beautiful little toddler, you have to be thinking about climate change. We were talking when we came on about your 106 or 7 degree heat index in Manhattan. We're seeing droughts, epic droughts, but then floods over here. Antarctica's 80 degrees above normal. Milan's running out of water. Europe's breaking heat records that we've never seen before. I mean, do you believe in science and gravity and around Earth? Where do you put this in your nighttime thoughts when you look at that pretty little baby?
It's right there with gun violence, man. Like I don't know what kind of world she's going to inherit, whether it's even going to be habitable or not. You know, I wrote a lot of climate speeches for President Obama, and it just drove us nuts that I'd say maybe for the first 5 years, I'd spend a lot of time in speeches like explaining the science and pushing back on deniers. And ultimately I was just like, you know what, fuck this and fuck them. Like, let's just make fun of them. You know, and we just started switching to mocking climate deniers, and, you know, he had to do pretty much everything on the climate via executive action or treaty powers like Paris, because there just weren't the votes in Congress to do anything about the climate. Now, you know, you saw Biden, over the summer finally passed this just like extraordinary climate bill that is probably going to do more to save the planet than anything else we've done so far. And that's not necessarily a super high bar, but you know, you look at what experts are saying about it and they're thrilled. You don't get that very often from policy experts. So that gives me an awful lot of hope. You know, it makes me think about my students too. I teach now at Northwestern University where I went for undergraduate. I teach speech writing. And you see, they've grown up a lot differently than I did. And, you know, they're only 20 years younger. I grew up I was born in 1980, right? And in the 80s and 90s, America was just the colossus of the world, right? We were hot shit. And, you know, the economy was booming in the 90s and You know, it seemed like the only thing Americans fought about was pop culture, and life was pretty good. You know, all things considered, it's probably about as good as life got in America, despite, you know, I'm sure I know there were a ton of flaws with it. But, and then you've got, you know, my students this year were born in 2000, and their life kind of kicked off with 9/11 and a massive recession and two wars. And, you know, their parents are touched by these things. And they grow up surrounded by this and pandemic. And it feels like, and a climate, obviously, that's changing by the day. And a lot of them had active shooter drills in their schools. That's a different way to grow up than I did. So their vision of politics is much different than mine. We all kind of share the same policy desires. They're a lot more impatient about it, and rightly so. I mean, you know, they look at a gerontocracy that is not doing enough to protect them. They're going to be, you know, 50 years old, 60 years old when the planet really starts getting uninhabitable, maybe. And they're rightly pissed off about it. So they're much more impatient with the pace of change. And, you know, I try to get them to channel that into going right into public service and going to write speeches and, you know, positioning themselves to run for something, because it's really the only way it's going to change. You know, I can't stand that politics is run by a bunch of white people in their 70s and 80s who just don't know what my students' lives have been like, or what, you know, poorer Americans or browner Americans or gayer Americans' lives have been like. It is time for some new blood to get in there that actually approaches the future in a way that's worthy of young people right now.
Cody, given all of that, how do you stay hopeful, optimistic, and not just crawl into a dark closet and curl up with some whiskey?
Well, it's still my students, right? They've already gone to be, one of my students became the chief speechwriter for the governor of Illinois at 22. Others have gone into governor mansions, mayor's offices, joined the Biden campaign. So I'm slowly kind of, you know, seeding politics with a bunch of great idealistic young people who I taught how to write speeches. That makes me hopeful, because they're not going to stop. You know, my daughter, obviously, I don't think this makes me different than any other father, but I watch her every day say a new word or learn how to do something. And it's just like, Jesus Christ, like, wow. like, oh my, how did she learn how to do that? And I feel, you know, it's kind of the same imposter syndrome as working in the White House. It's like every day I think I'm being a bad father, no matter what I do. I can be literally sitting with her all day long, reading books and teaching her things and feeding her. And I'm like, I am not doing enough for this kid. You know, she makes me hopeful, and it's really incumbent on us to make sure that she inherits a better world. You know, I dedicate the end of the acknowledgments is all for her. And I tell her that I, to never get cynical, there are going to be so many reasons to think that the world's never going to get better, because that's what, you know, the media focuses on. That's what too many politicians focus on. But if you look, there are people everywhere who are working tirelessly and quietly to make this world a better place. And I advised her to always seek out those people and surround herself with those people. And life will be better that way.
You've been listening to the What Matters Most podcast, a 100% listener-supported program. If you feel inspired, please go to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/whatmattersmost and join our family. So until the next time, stay inspired and in the light.